Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is December 6th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. We received a profoundly optimistic message this morning from Lyndon LaRouche. Many of our listeners and supporters of the LaRouche movement may be wondering, why is he optimistic, given that we are entering into what he has accurately characterized as a new dark age? The global financial system has collapsed. There is idiocy in the efforts in Washington and Wall Street and London to address the collapse. There's a spread of hunger, disease, and civil war, and the British Empire has just launched a new round of deadly terrorism, most recently in Mumbai, India. So under these circumstances, what could possibly make Lyndon LaRouche optimistic? Today on the program, we will explore the unique quality of human creativity, which is the cause, and perhaps the only legitimate cause, for the optimism expressed by Mr. LaRouche in his message, at a moment when the predatory forces of the Anglo-Dutch Empire have unleashed this destructive new dark age against human society. We will look at the most powerful tool that we have developed over the course of human history, which is the cause of this optimism. And that tool is classical culture. Today we will investigate how classical drama, and especially tragedy, give us the capacity to develop the kind of self-conscious reflection that can enable us to communicate profound and impassioned ideas at a moment of crisis, which can break our fellow citizens out of their long-term stupor so they may act to overcome this present existential crisis. My guests today include Robert Beltran, an actor who has been in a collaborative relationship with Lyndon LaRouche and with me and with the LaRouche Youth Movement for more than 7 years, Jerry Rose, who has written numerous articles on the Greeks and Shakespeare, and LaRouche Youth Movement member Joanne McAndrew, who has been working in workshops with Robert Beltran over the last several years. So I'd like to welcome the three of you to the LaRouche Show.
Hi, Harley.
Good to be here, Harley.
Now, let me begin with Robert, because I know that when you think back over the last 8 years of Bush and Cheney and all that's happened, that you have not been happy by what you've seen in the culture and civilization. Yet I know that you are deep down an optimist. So I'd like to ask, what role does art, especially classical drama, play in keeping you going?
Well, Harley, I'm so optimistic because we have this new president that's going to change everything for the better, right? I mean, he's just so much a reason for being optimistic. He's got all the answers.
Well, that's our job.
You know, what we do is with the Lynn in the drama classes, we investigate, first of all, what the play means and its subtext. And we then start working on the scenes and through as actors, and then through that investigation, we see how the playwright expresses the themes of the play that he wants to put across to the audience, how he does it in minute detail within the text and the subtext. And all of this is done, of course, with the with what LaRouche has been saying for many years now about a constitutes a tragic culture. So we investigate these plays, trying to figure out what is it in the cultures that we are in the specific plays are investigating. What is it that makes it tragic, and thereby we get a kind of mirror of our own culture.
Well, in talking about tragic culture and the way drama functions, Lynn often writes that you have to go beyond the words, which is what you, I think, are getting at when you use the term subtext. So how do you find the subtext in a drama? How do you know what the the playwright, the tragedian, meant in the communication, because often there are ironies embedded within it, and it's my experience that most people in our culture today miss those ironies. So how do you go about investigating it to find them?
Yeah, what we are up against right at the beginning is the fact that our culture has very little sense of history. And so when you're working on a play like Don Carlos by Schiller, it's essentially a historical document. And so we're looking back at a time that was tragic, and the way that Schiller expresses this is that it, not just through the dialogue on the face of the page, but through how these characters are trying to survive in this tragic culture. Are they contributing to it? Are they fighting against it? Are they submitting to it without even knowing that they're submitting to it? What are the axioms of the culture that everybody seems to take for granted and believe in? And the only way that you can get to that understanding is to delve into the subtext, and as the characters relate in the culture that's being painted by Schiller, and you just start understanding that the whole thing is the whole tragedy of the culture is being driven by these obvious but also the more unseen forces that that play a very concrete part in what's driving this culture to its tragedy.
This is what Lynn referred to in his work, The Mask of Nancy Pelosi, as the invisible electric fence, then, the axioms that shape the actions of people that they may not be conscious of, but you have to make the audience conscious of them.
Yes, like in Don Carlos, you have the Inquisition, that, and the power of the papacy, the Roman See, the Catholic Church, powered in Rome, and you come to realize during the course of the play that everything is driven by this unseen power, and the characters react, and that live in this within this unseen force that's driving everything mm-hmm. in the play, and the subtext comes out of that.
Now, you've been working recently in Los Angeles. I know you added to the work with Schiller and Shakespeare. You've added the readings of Greek tragedy. What do you find? What have you found so far from that that gives you this? I assume you're developing a real appreciation for the Greeks from this.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of bad translations out there, but we've managed to find some good ones. What we're finding is that there's a similarity. There are principles that these tragedians share, and that is that they paint these cultures that are in the grips of a tragedy or, careening towards a tragedy. They share the idea of this unforeseen, this unseen force that is causing people to act in their own worst interest, almost a blind belief in the axioms of their culture, mm-hmm. and that becomes very clear when you in the Greek tragedies that we've been reading, and also the Don Carlos and the playwright Julius Caesar, which we investigated, you know, several years ago.
Right. Well, Jerry, you know, Lynn has been emphasizing quite a bit recently the importance of Homer's Iliad as the basis of all classical tragedy. And I know you've done a lot of work on this. What is it about the Iliad that is so crucial?
Well, it's Homer. Homer is a great poet, and he lays the basis for all the Greek classical art that comes after him. It is amazing because there has been a debate, a crazy debate, about did tragedy come from the dithyrambic choruses and orgiastic dancing, which was Nietzsche's view, and therefore, because it was done at Dionysian festivals, right? And this ecstatic creativity comes from ecstasy or something like that. Whereas every classic poet, and Homer being the first that we know of in terms of written, well, he didn't write it, actually. They used to sing it. It got written later. But look, what happened in the war on Troy, it really happened. And this this guy Heinrich Schliemann, who was a great German archaeologist, knew, the British had said it didn't happen. It was just an invention of Homer. And Schliemann said, no way. And he actually found Troy. And what he found in his dig in Troy was that every successive layer of sediment after Troy was less and less civilized. In other words, what ensued from the war in Troy was a dark age, and not just in that area around Troy, which is Turkey, an area in Turkey right now, but all of Greek civilization went through a dark age because it was a massive depopulation of all the Greek tribes. And of course, in the Odyssey, you learn that in the return from Troy, Agamemnon was killed by his wife Clytemnestra, which was the basis for Aeschylus's Orestean trilogy, right? In which he takes the return of Agamemnon from Troy, because in order to start the Trojan War, for the Greeks to actually get off the island of Aulis, where they had been trapped by adverse winds, they couldn't get off the island. They had to commit. Agamemnon had to kill his oldest daughter at the request of the gods. That if you want to get off this island to start this war, you're going to have to commit a blood sacrifice of your own child.
So that's not a very good way to start something.
Not a good way, but also, and then of course Clytemnestra wreaks havoc when Agamemnon comes home. It's very complicated. I'm not going to go through it, but the point is that this happened, and not only was Troy destroyed, but Greek civilization was destroyed, and that's clear. The ornateness of their pottery, certain other indications of the use of certain materials, advanced materials, they all went out of existence.
Well, let me, because both you and Robert now have mentioned the importance of these dramas as history, and I know in this article I mentioned earlier by LaRouche, U.S. Politics as Tragedy, Shakespeare as a Scholar, he talks about the importance of the real history being told in tragedy. So as a principle then, what we're really looking at is the development and also the impediments to the development of human civilization in these tragedies.
Well, I just want to get at this point on Homer because it's fascinating.
Go ahead.
Because Homer was predominant, as was Schiller, as was Shakespeare. I wrote a whole article on this. Were predominantly historians. In other words, they were trying to look at why civilization, what happened to our culture, to our people. Why are we so disparate at this point? And of course, Homer, and this is not to be forgotten. He puts it at the whim of the gods. That the war in Troy was at the whim of the gods, whispering in different people's ears, "You can do this. You can't do this. You can do this. You can't do this," these gods were a bunch of heteronomic jerks, which Homer understood and portrays them as such. They do things at a whim. And therefore, the lawfulness in society, the idea of the individual and the development of the individual becomes circumscribed by a set of arbitrary actions, right? And that the tragedy starting as early as Homer is that people cannot break free of the whim of the gods, who are heteronomic, and really Aeschylus in the Prometheus trilogy breaks the mold. And so does in the Oresteian trilogy, the mold gets broken with the goddess Pallas Athene, at least in the Oresteian trilogy. And in the Prometheus trilogy, which we don't have, but we know at least where it goes, in the Prometheus trilogy, Prometheus defies the gods, literally, and gives man fire, i.e. knowledge. But Homer understood, Schiller says this very beautifully, he says, the poet may be it may be born in a certain time, but never let him be of that age. And Homer is portraying the gods, and imagine the way this Homeric epics were delivered were to thousands of Greeks sitting in an amphitheater. Thousands. It was a series of mass educations, sung, and at times danced. At least aspects of it were dramatized, right? Which is where the drama comes from. That's what the point I want to get at.
Yeah.
The drama does not come from orgiastic, ecstatic experiences. What it comes from explicitly, and this you can prove, it comes from a dramatization of critical aspects of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And other myths, but really legends, not myths. That's a bad word. Legends, right? So that Homer was sung, and they dramatized parts of that. It was not the choruses sang, and then the individual emerged out of the chorus. It was the individual who sang. From the Iliad and the Odyssey. And out of that, poets dramatized aspects of it.
Well, let me, I really want to take up this question of presenting history, and I'll get to Joanne in just a moment, who's been doing some hands-on work on this. But I want to come back then to this question that Lynn talks about, which is that what you're looking at is the history of the development of the powers of the human being. Now, when you present a scene, and this is for Robert, how do you get across the intention of the dramatist and not merely recite the words that he's put on the page? We sort of touched on this, but I'd like you to elaborate a little more.
Well, when you read the play, you get a sense of what the play is about. And sometimes it can be a very shallow perception, or it can be a very deep perception, depending on what you know about history and how deeply you've studied. In working with the limb, we have the advantage of many of LaRouche's writings and speeches to always refer back to, which gives us a deeper understanding of the history within the plays. So when you're so consequently, when the actors are looking for motivation for the underlying subtext that moves their characters psychologically in the psychological action through the play, then these actors, because of their association and their study of history, and especially as LaRouche presented, you get a deeper sense, and so the actors have a deeper meaning. They can get across, or try to get across, that deeper meaning, which most actors today in the universities, I would say, and in the professional world, just don't, because many of them come out of the university system, just don't have that sense of history, and in the same way that the members of the limb do.
So when they're asking before a scene, what's my motivation, they usually are not asking about the historic context, as opposed to just taking someone out of history, and it could even be thinking about how they would react in a situation.
Yeah. For instance, in Don Carlos, the play opens up with Don Carlos this guy Domingo, who is a monk, a representative of the Catholic Church. And there's a dialogue that goes on between them. And you can take the dialogue on face value. It's very provoking, and just on its face value. But when you bring in the deeper subtext of the historical context of the play, then what you really see is a rotten culture that is in the grips of a tragedy, and how it affects Don Carlos, who is of the young generation, the generation of the limb members, the 18 to 25, 18 to 35 generation. You see how it acts on his psychology, and we see that this is a very troubled, very deeply wounded, psychologically wounded human being that is that has no recourse to heal himself except through a great idea, a great challenge for the betterment of humankind, which is brought in by the Marquis Posa, who says, look, we need you to help save the Netherlands. The Netherlands is in revolt against the Inquisition. And King Philip is suppressing that revolt and refusing to see how he's losing his grip on his, essentially his most, the countries of the Netherlands were rich and provided so much to the empire, mm-hmm. that he was losing them. And so Don Carlos starts out at the beginning of the play as being destabilized and psychologically wounded with no no sense of a bigger life or challenge beyond his immediate circumstances that he can devote his life to, until the Marquis Posa comes in and says, "We need you. The Netherlands needs you." And that's when he starts to find his humanity again.
And yet we also know, because Schiller has written so much of this, that Posa's conception himself is also clouded by his failure to recognize what he's dealing with, what the problems in the culture are. It's quite fascinating that we do have in the case of Schiller, we have his history, the revolt of the Netherlands, and then we also have his letters on Don Carlos to work with. And I know you have people utilizing them to develop their sense of the character. Now, Joanne, you've done some work on the Don Carlos play, am I right?
Yep.
What scenes are you working on, and how are you getting a sense of this broader picture of history that Schiller presents, and how that gives you a capability to do things in terms of mobilizing people around these ideas?
Well, one thing I'd bring up initially, just even in what you brought up just now about the Marquis, and also, you know, it refers back to what Lynn brings up about the Iliad, is that you have the Marquis who, you know, who kind of has a sense of wanting to do good, but his method by which he does it is he uses the principles of tragedy to try and manipulate other people to do what, you know, this idea of, well, the ends will justify the means. Mm-hmm. And when Lynn brings up the question of the Iliad, and when you begin reading the Iliad, the thing that is most striking from the very beginning is the way that people are manipulated, the whispering in the ear, well, if you do this, you're going to get in trouble, or if you don't do this, you're not going to get accepted. And, of course, this is the exact same thing that's going on in society today, and something that Skye goes through in a very good way in this basement interview, to say that's, you know, society is manipulated by these whisperings in the ear. And even in Don Carlos, you see that from the very first scene with Domingo, is that Domingo is trying to manipulate Carlos, to keep him destabilized, to stop him from wanting to rise above the degenerate culture that he's a part of. So looking at these different things, I think it's very crucial when approaching a scene. I've done some work recently on this Eboli soliloquy, where the scene before is, well, I've also worked on the scene between Eboli and Carlos, where Eboli's in love with Carlos, and she has convinced herself that Carlos is in love with her. And you have this whole very comedic scene where, you know, Eboli's throwing herself at Carlos, and Carlos thinks that, see, Carlos has gotten this letter, which he thinks is from the queen, you know, who he's in love with. And so he thinks he's just accidentally walked into the wrong room. and he's trying to get out of there because he wants to go see the queen. And Eboli can't understand why he's trying to get away. And she thinks he's just playing. He's very timid. And she's like, oh, man, he's just, you know, totally inexperienced and totally shy. You know, and so she just keeps trying harder and harder and harder. And of course, at the end of the scene, it's revealed that, you know, he doesn't love her, he loves somebody else, and she's very distraught and upset. And then what you see within the soliloquy is a situation where Eboli totally gives herself over to the culture. And you've seen it in scenes before. You have this garden scene with the queen and all her women, and the women are talking about how they can't wait to get to Madrid to see all the heretics get burned at the stake and to see the bullfights. So you see the level of degeneracy. But then what you see with Eboli in some of the scene with Carlos, where she actually kind of professes her ideal of what love is, and you know, and also that she doesn't lack the court. That she doesn't like this court. You know, I would have forsaken this court, I would have forsaken the whole world, except that I'm in love with someone, and that binds me still to existence. But then in this soliloquy, she realizes that Carlos loves the queen, and the queen is the most sublime person in the whole play, and it's somebody that Eboli, you know, probably if it wasn't for the queen, Eboli would already be totally degenerate, you know, totally sucked into the culture. So you see in the scene where she starts to think, well, hang on, if Carlos loves her, well, she must love him. And she goes through, you know, I admired the queen. I thought this of her. I thought that of her. But, you know, she's just as bad as everybody else. And, you know, and then Eboli, you know, cries out for revenge and plays a crucial role in the, you know, in the overall tragedy, you know, of total destruction of the queen, of Carlos, of the Marquis, of everyone. So you see, and it's crucial with these plays that, you know, this principle of tragedy has to be in the back of your mind all the time. And that's what Lynn goes after with the Iliad, because in today's society, the principle of tragedy doesn't exist. That's an opinion. That's not proven. It's, you know, there is no principle of tragedy. You know, Hamlet is really just about a boy who gets scorned by a girl and, you know, has a fit and can't handle it. And that's all you can know of Hamlet. There's nothing more to it. So I think, you know, and that's why Lynn is getting at the Iliad, because you can trace the principle of tragedy, you know, way back to the beginning, and that it's existed there throughout, you know, throughout all of human history.
Well, this brings up an irony, and I just want to identify for our listeners. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, and we're here today, December 6, 2008, and we're discussing this question of tragedy and drama, because there's a real irony here, which is that we have a society careening into tragic outcome, with war, with chaos, financial collapse, and yet human beings are creative and capable of reversing a tragedy. And what we're getting at is how, in the hands of great dramatists, tragedy is used to evoke that which is human. And I'd like to throw out both to Robert and Jerry your thoughts on this question, which is, how does tragedy function once you get inside it, as we see Joanne is clearly work through this question in Don Carlos of the tragedy. I know both of you have. How does tragedy play that role of moving people so that they can get above the tragedy that they face? Jerry, you want to?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this was essential because I think Joanne hit it right. There's a principle of tragedy in the culture. Right, in all cultures, to the extent that people will not change and go along to get along, is the principle of tragedy. And most societies and most cultures function that way. But as we know, you hit a physical limit. And therefore, those axioms of policy will destroy the very people who have them. And therefore, this principle of tragedy that impels the poet, that impels the political leader who is poetic, and this is Shelley's brilliant piece in Defense of Poetry, forces certain individuals to face the horror of what's about to happen and find within themselves a sublime power. And Schiller says in On the Pathetic, he says, history is a sublime subject. Because it's when you find individuals like a Franklin Roosevelt or a Lincoln, or I'm studying myself now, Washington. These are sublime individuals who out of a love of humanity, which is what motivates Prometheus, out of a love of humanity, find the necessary new ideas to allow humanity to overcome this tragic principle. And by displaying this tragic principle and the awful consequences of it. In other words, look, Homer is clear. The consequences of, and every Greek knew it, the consequences of the Trojan War was a total disaster for Priam, who was the king of
Troy.
Troy, and Achilles. Both get destroyed, and both civilizations get destroyed. And it's precisely emerging out of showing the populations, the Greek populations, the insanity of this kind of approach to dealing with things. Because in the Odyssey, there's a whole other principle involved, which makes it not a tragedy, which I won't go through, but there's a whole other organizing principle in the Odyssey, which actually emerges in the goddess palace Athene, which is the basis for founding Athens, which Sophocles understands very, very well, and Aeschylus understands very well at the end of the Oresteian trilogy. But unless people face the fact that their normal way that they function is going to destroy them and their families and civilization, that they have to rise above that. That is the purpose of classic tragedy. But it has to be devastating. You can't give, oh, if only the hero did that. Forget it. As Lynn constantly hits us, that is romantic nonsense.
I guess that's part of the difficulty in thinking about this, because here we are, you would think that people today could look at the look at what's happening with this bailout, where they're literally funneling trillions of dollars into a bottomless pit as though this is somehow going to solve a problem. And then they see Paulson come on television and change his policy 4 times in 4 weeks, and yet he's still confident it will work. And in a sense, if you look at current history as tragedy, people don't get it in current history. Do you think, Robert, there's an element here of having to take people out of what's familiar so they actually can look at something that's not so familiar and then through that see these principles? For example, that's why Shakespeare or Schiller or the Greeks would work today, whereas someone just seeing a documentary, it doesn't quite move them.
Right, yeah. What becomes clearer and clearer in these plays is two principles that are in conflict. You know, one is the man as beast principle, and the other, you know, it's opposite, man as a creative human being. And you know, within these cultures, sometimes you have someone who is trying to act as a creative human being and is, you know, going, fighting against the pricks, kicking against the pricks, as Lynn has been saying more and more. Mm-hmm. Those who would promote the corruption because they're benefiting from the corruption without any sympathy for those who are suffering because of the corruption. So, you know, the tragic principle, I think, is based on that duality, and so in these cultures, these tragic cultures, like in Don Carlos or any of the Shakespeare tragedies or the Greek tragedies, you have a predominant oligarchy that is set on promoting the corruption from which they benefit. Mm-hmm. And
sort of like George Soros and Felix Rowetin today.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you do have occasionally a person, whether wittingly or unwittingly, fights against that. You know, Don Carlos eventually does that. Hamlet has an epiphany. It's too late, though, by the time he has it. Who is the daughter in the Greek tragedy who defies Creon? And
Antigone.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have these individuals, but sometimes the corruption and the degeneracy of the culture is just too overwhelming. And what Lynn has been saying is that you know, part of that tragedy are these individuals who potentially could change the society for the better, could open people's minds, and their creativity, instead of acting as cattle. You have these individuals who are defeated, basically, by the corrupt culture. It's just too overwhelmingly powerful for them to overcome.
Well, and then, Joanne, when you work on the Don Carlos, as you were talking about Eboli and this whole the whole series of other characters who were brought in, you actually do get a pretty good cross-section of at least people who were either with the program, with the Inquisition, or were going along with it, or those who were chafing at it, still basically were responding to that society. That is, they were enfolded in the axioms of the corruption. Does that, when you read that, when you work on that, how do you take that then to the organizing when you're talking to people to give them a sense that they don't have to succumb to the culture?
Yeah, well, that's the challenge, because that's exactly what you get in the population is that wide-ranging, you know, the variant of characters that are, you know, involved in a different level of having given in to that culture. And this is also what Lynn's bringing up with today's tragedy is that, you know, the solutions are there. The option to solve this problem is there, but the population is so, you know, so conditioned to destroy what it is that could actually save the society. And, you know, it's something that's being addressed in this, with this question of, with Riemann, this question of dynamics, you know, is looking at these principles that are constantly affecting your society. So you have these individuals that you meet on the street that think that they're, you know, that they're above the problem or they know the way out, but then after having some discussion with them, you can begin to see exactly what it is that their problem, you know, that they're caught up in this culture. And, you know, for example, just yesterday at Temple University, you know, I met this student that was adamant that there was no way that you could understand any truth. There's no principles that govern the universe. And he said, you know, yeah, sure, okay, you can say right now that gravitation is holding my feet firmly on the ground. He says, but there's nothing to say that in 5 minutes' time I don't float away. You know, there's no principles. You can't know the principles. The principles will change, you know, and they can change in 5 minutes. And I said to him, I said, so you're telling me that there is no way that we can know what to do to deal with this economic collapse that we're in? And he said, no, it's just trial and error. We'll have to see what works. And I said, so you don't recognize that what Lincoln did, what Franklin Roosevelt did, you know, what JFK did, you know, these guys were trying to institute the American system of economics. And that happened to miraculously, you know, develop society. So you say there's no correlation between the fact that they all used the same principles and it had the same effect. He's like, no, absolutely not. You know, so you have these various levels within society of people that have already, you know, either totally succumbed to the culture or, you know, are at the point of doing so. You know, we've had other people coming around here in Philadelphia, you know, someone that's been studying physics and has been exposed to a lot of the basement work. And, of course, it totally contradicts what he's learning in the classroom. I think at the moment he's thinking of taking some time off to study Gauss, Riemann, Leibniz to actually find out whether, you know, what we're saying is real or what his professors are teaching him.
So, Joanne, you don't know this, but you actually just answered a question that was emailed in by a listener who's familiar to you by the name of Brian, who asked, how would you start a drama or compose a drama to show these problems today? And, of course, the description you just gave of this character on the campus is an example of that. But I think there's a bit of a problem in your time actually constructing a drama. And I'd like to throw this out to Robert. You know, again, when we look back at history, we can see, because things did happen, as Jerry pointed out, the Trojan War was real. Richard III was a tyrant. The Plantagenet kings of England were disasters. But then you have to get at this question. I mean, Shakespeare was writing about these things within 100, 200 years of them happening. When he wrote something more contemporary, Henry VIII, it didn't work that well. What do you think? Do you think that you can construct a drama that does effectively communicate the tragedy of the time, or do you think it helps to have that historic distance?
Well, I think, you know, in the case of Shakespeare and Henry VIII, you know, he was living under the Queen of England, who was Henry VIII's daughter.
Yeah.
So he had to be pretty cautious.
Yeah.
But yet when King James became the King of England, Shakespeare wrote Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, the personages in the play, are the direct descent. King James was the direct descendant of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was there's a sense of the intervention has to be, you know, tailored to the time that you're in, I guess. But, you know, in our own time, we've had very powerful plays that have been sort of censored or mocked, or, you know, playwrights like Clifford Odets,
mm-hmm.
who wrote The Big Knife, saw very clearly what was going to happen, or what was happening since the death of Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
In our own time, I don't know. I don't know that anybody is doing anything as universal as that. We do have people who are, you know, talking about the AIDS epidemic and, you know, the various issue-oriented plays. But
well, you just said one of the key words, which is universal, because I presume that what you mean by that is, in a drama, for it to function on this level, it has to address these kinds of universal questions that confront civilizations, of the ability to speak truth to power, so to speak, or the question of the, as Jerry was saying, the universal tendency to try to go along to get along rather than to stand up and fight.
And, you know, I think, you know, I'd like to hear what Jerry has to say about this, but I see these, you know, people like Aeschylus and Shakespeare and Schiller as interventionists.
Sure.
I see them as heroes.
Sure.
That stood
they
up
are.
To the oligarchy of their time.
Look, one of the most vilified dramatists was Euripides.
Yeah.
And he was incredible, as was Marlowe.
Yeah.
Because it was in the middle of the Peloponnesian Wars, where the Athenians were just committing atrocity after atrocity, and he hated it, and he was very close to Socrates, in fact, Euripides, and in fact it was said that Socrates wrote some of the parts of his plays, but he ripped into by going back to the Trojan Wars. And the inhumanity that the Greeks showed to the Trojans in three or four of his plays. And he put them on in Athens.
Yeah.
Right? So the point is that often, Harley, it's a good question. And I think Robert hit at it with the big knife. It's got to be universal. Sometimes you can get at the universal, as did Euripides, by pointing back to another time to show them what the hell and how inhuman they were and where it led.
Yeah.
Right? But it becomes universal because it's not in your time, right? But it's in another time, and you're reflecting, as Schiller points out, on another time, and you're saying, oh my God. Oh my God! I mean, you know, You know, I mean, when you read, as Joanne will tell you, when you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, but particularly the Iliad, when you read the Iliad, you really get angry at the gods. You know, and I don't think Homer was kidding about that.
Yeah.
You get angry and you find they're capricious and comical on some level. Their caprice is somewhat comical. And you're laughing at the gods. So can you imagine all these Greek tribes sitting around laughing at Zeus? You know? Or all these Greek tribes. And, you know, for the show, I read a funny history. It was an interesting history of the Greek drama. Do you realize there was 14,000 people sitting in the goddamn theater?
Yeah.
14,000.
Yeah.
To 17,000 people. Right? And imagine playing Prometheus Unbound or Bound. Everyone's pissed off at Zeus as a tyrant. Imagine 17,000 Greeks thinking the same thing.
Or, Jerry, the other example you used of Orestes,
yes.
The pride of the citizens of Athens, and also the sense of responsibility that comes through at the end of the play.
Yes.
When Athena says, get rid of your rage, you must be the guardians of
yes,
mercy.
Of natural law, of natural
yeah.
law. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. So the point is that, you know, it's a very interesting, I think what Barbara points out in The Big Knife, Odets was a genius. I mean, he really was.
Mm-hmm.
He got it. He saw, yeah. So you can be of an age, I mean, in an age, but you cannot be of it. He saw the principles that were violated by
yeah.
McCarthyism and the destruction that led to. And I can imagine the audience that first saw Odette's play, they must have been totally moved by it. I mean, I'm moved by it today.
That's what I mean.
And, you know, so I don't think it's per se the subject matter.
Well, Robert, you were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the courage that it took for these playwrights as interventionists to say what they were saying to their own people and putting the mirror up to their own people and saying, look, this is what you've become and this is what it can only get worse if we don't change. I mean, you know, eventually Odette was brought up with the, you know, the House Un-American Activities brought
right.
him
right.
up for charges of being anti-American, right? A communist.
Yeah, Euripides was run out of Athens, by the way.
Yeah, and Schiller was on the run for a while.
And Socrates was poisoned.
Yeah.
So that would seem to indicate that if you want to tell the truth, you're going to have some trouble in your time.
More than likely.
Yeah, Joanne, just to pick this up then. Here we are, if you take what I discussed at the beginning, the irony of Lyndon LaRouche talking about the optimism he has that we can make a change, even with, we know Obama was put in by Soros, but we also see that you have the Clintons being brought in, the institution of the presidency. So how do we communicate these ideas to the population? And Joanne, let me just ask you this. When you're organizing and you're talking to people, do the people that you're talking to today on the streets of Philly or wherever you're organizing, do they have a sense that they're living in what are tragic times?
I think in the very rare case.
Yeah.
I think it varies. But, yeah, there are some people that have a sense that, you know, some people that can accept the fact, well, that understand that we're heading for a dark age, but for the most part, I mean, we have a sign out in the street that says, this is not a recession, this is not a depression, this is a new dark age. And for the most part, students look at this sign and just crack up laughing.
I usually make the joke that, you know, you say it's a dark age and someone looks out and says, yeah, but the sun's shining. Because we have an ahistorical population.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think the crucial thing is that we, and that's obviously why, you know, we're working on the drama, the question of developing the acting capabilities to actually present these profound tragedies. you know, and not just, you know, one act or two acts, but we need to be able to present the, you know, the entire tragedy, because, and the principle of tragedy is that you want to move your population to shake off the chains that have been put on their culture. And on this question of Odette's, the other play that I'd bring up that I think is that's really crucial is Waiting for Lefty. And it took me a little to kind of figure this play out, because Lynn talks about Waiting for Lefty as a classical tragedy. And, you know, what you see in this play is that Odette's, you know, it starts off as a union meeting, and it's these taxi drivers, this is in the 30s.
Right.
You know, it's the Great Depression. Do we strike? Don't we strike? And everyone's been saying, no, we've got to go along to get along. We've got to go along to get along. And then Odette's, you know, he takes these people's lives that are part of this union and puts them up on show, and he takes a whole spectrum of society to just show you, you know, how controlled the situation is. Well, no, you can't go against this. You know, you have a doctor who's been caring for, you know, for ill patients that can't afford health care, and, you know, the head doctor says, well, no, this section's being shut down. And then you have another person who's, you know, a scientist who's going to spy on another scientist because they're preparing, I think it's, you know, biochemical warfare weapons. And, you know, the one guy says, no, I'm going to stand up to this. And that's the thing with Odette, with Waiting for Lefty, is it's people's decision to rise above it and say, I don't care what the consequences are. I'm not going to sit back and take this anymore. Kind of like, you know, it's the Promethean principle that I don't care what Zeus is going to do to me. He can torture me, he can send me to hell, you know, I don't care. I'm going to stand up and fight, you know, for man's creativity. And, you know, by the end of the Odette's play, the play ends where they've made the decision to strike. And apparently the first time this play was ever performed, the entire audience was standing up demanding to strike.
They were standing up chanting, strike, strike.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Robert, this... Now, we only have a couple minutes left, so let me throw this out to you, and then if Jerry has something on this. You obviously believe that working on drama, that actually working on these plays, getting the subtext and presenting it, does enhance your powers to communicate in everything you do. I presume that's why you do it.
Yes.
So how does that function?
Well, you know, you can't really hear Beethoven if you don't have the musicians that can play their instruments and do a competent job in presenting a Beethoven symphony. And so you have to develop the actors to be able to do these plays. And then once they can do these plays, then they're an effective tool to use to change the society. Because if you don't have the actors that understand and are not just to be able to do it, but also understand the deeper meaning of the play, then you're going to have, you know, just another production of Hamlet where, you know, the actor playing Hamlet gets to masturbate on stage, you know, in front of everybody. And the audience goes away thinking about, oh, you know, poor Hamlet and Ophelia. Too bad they didn't get together, you know. But if you have competent actors that have a real sense of mission and passion to see that mission through, to really understand the plays, to really know how to do them, perform them, then you have a tool that's available to you that will open the minds of the people in the culture just by the sheer passion of it and the sheer expertise that they bring to it.
And this,
let me add one thing.
Jerry, because, I was going to say very
yeah,
quickly.
Because I want to get at something. The power that the poet taps is the power of the actual universe itself.
Mm. Yeah.
And is capable of moving humans, which is Shelley's famous quote at the end of The Defense of Poetry. The poets are the unacknowledged legislators for mankind. And the power we unleash, both in music, in drama, in Lynn's writings, Shelley makes a big point about Socrates and Plato. We unleash this power and there is Zeus can do nothing against it.
And I think as we're winding down, we just have a few seconds left, this is what the Greeks meant by developing character, that you develop the full character, the human qualities, through these kinds of processes, through actually living a human life and experiencing the mind and internalizing the mind of a Socrates, a Sophocles, a Beethoven, and so on. But I wish we had more time, but we're out of time. This has been the LaRouche Show. It's archived on LaRouchePub.com. Get your friends to listen to it, and we'll be back next week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time with another edition of the LaRouche Show.